The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Hannah Dillon, staff writer at ExchangeWire, and joining me this week is Izzy Rivers, CEO of media and marketing agency Realm. How are you doing, Izzy?
I'm good, thanks. Slight cold, so sorry for the voice, but yeah, thanks for having me. It's great.
No problem at all. We're very grateful to have you. Appreciate that you've not been particularly well this week. So massive thank you for joining us. Also joining me this week is ExchangeWire's COO and tote bag fanatic, Lindsay Rowntree. How are you, Lindsay?
Tote bag fanatic. I actually opened up my work rucksack the other day and I whipped out three tote bags. I don't know how any of them even got in there. And I was like, how have I amassed this selection of tote bags in my rucksack for no reason whatsoever? So I would have, yeah, I have to agree with you. I can't disagree with any of that. Bizarre.
I think they've got a life of their own, really.
They seem to, in my household, yeah.
Do you collect tote bags or do tote bags collect you?
They collect me. Yep, I'm an easy mark.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Lindsay, for joining us this week as well. So starting with our first story, which is that research from content creation platform Verblio has revealed that 69% of in-house marketers and 75% of marketing agencies are turning to freelancers or content marketplaces for help. The survey of over 400 content marketers also uncovered that 21% of agencies say content creation generates over 75% of their revenue, and 62% of agencies are producing between 1 and 9 pieces of content per client each month. When identifying the main reasons for outsourcing, 43% of respondents listed a desire to produce content which is authentic and industry specific, while 29% identified client satisfaction as a priority. So, I'll come to you first, Izzy, on this, I think. What do you think these results suggest about the needs of marketers at the moment?
Well, one conversation that we're having a lot with clients at the moment is around that idea of authenticity that you touched on there. I do think that's a really important one. And I blame the TikTok, which I think has had quite a lot to do with it. But it's true, you know, social channels, quick, snackable content. I mean, it's only exacerbated, hasn't it? And actually, we're finding that clients and end users and customers, et cetera, are less worried about the quality of content sometimes now. Quality content tends to do one job, perhaps a longer term job, and the short term, quick. There's lots of companies coming up really quickly, video production companies, a lot of them in the US, where they will turn a video around for $700 or £1,000. They'll turn it around in 2 days. And just record customers or people on the streets and make little handheld videos that look more like the TikToks and the, you know, and the Instas and all the rest of it. So I think that consumption's driving a lot of it, potentially. I imagine agencies will bring that in-house or clients will bring that in-house eventually as they catch. You often find this come out and then come back in again, right? So yeah, I would say that'd be my first point, would definitely be the authenticity point, making it real and timely and relevant. People want things that are relevant for now. It tends to disappear after that because it's so hard to index the amount of content that exists in the world, whether that's online or whether that's in app or wherever that's hosted. People just want to see it, relate to it, and move on to the next thing, I think.
Yeah. Lindsay, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, I think I agree with that. It was interesting to see the stats on this. I think because, as Izzy says, there is this notion now of content being so fundamentally important that there is a need to actually outsource it in the first place. And I think that what's interesting for me is the fact that they are going down a route of content. I think of outsourcing. I don't really think about content outsourcing. And the reasoning behind it was... that one of the big reasons behind it was, we want to make sure that we are kind of getting channel experts in different realms. Sorry, there's a lot of talking in the background. It's distracting me massively. Can everyone shut up, please? Thank you. No, you need to edit that out, honestly. The audience will understand. I think that the reason driving it is they want the experts to be able to produce this content, and they realise they haven't got that. Even the content marketing agencies themselves maybe haven't got that in-house. And the marketers certainly don't. So, because I think people are probably always fascinated by the fact that agencies would be outsourcing because, well, you are outsourced, you're an outsourced tool in the first place. But actually, you know, beyond content, it's very, very common for agencies to outsource. It's often cost-driven, it's often expertise-driven. And I think that the fact that cost didn't really come up in this was, for me, the most interesting thing. Because in my experience of outsourcing, having worked for an agency, it was often driven by cost and resource and scale. And I think that the fact that this is being driven by, you know, as Izzy said, the authenticity aspect of it, and the fact that people are looking for the experts in certain fields to really be able to drive home the value of content is probably a really interesting thing. And as Izzy said, I you know, there probably is a big trend at the moment of people going, right, I need content. Where do I start with that? How do I even go about that? And eventually, once they've worked out how to do it, they might then start in-housing it.
Yeah, I think they want a lot of content and they want it quickly. Mm. And actually, we have ever such interesting conversations with clients about measuring the success of content, which I think is really important because, I mean, that must be a driving factor between this requirement for authenticity or multiple formats or whatever it is, because why are they asking for it? What are the data points that they're looking at that makes them think they need that in the first place? It's a really interesting question. And we do find that it's the nuance that drives content success. All advertisers are doing the same kind of content. They're all moving into the same areas. They're all doing the same things. Everyone wants that viral piece, or they want the bit that's going to magically get them more leads than they thought they were going to have before. And it's the little things that drive the edge on that. That extra bit of humor, being culturally relevant in market, not just translated in market. You know, those are the things that they're measuring and seeing. I need a channel expert that really understands Facebook, really understands LinkedIn, really understands how these things work to drive that edge, because otherwise it's going to get lost in a sea of other stuff because everyone's just doing the same thing. So, yeah.
But then how, I guess the question there is, like, you know, the experts need to understand and know how to differentiate, but given that everything is the same and actually, you know, you go onto TikTok, you pick a topic, any topic, everything is still largely the same. There's small variances in the same thing. How do you do that, but also differentiate? I guess that's where the experts come in, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And I think sometimes the experts aren't the people you think they're going to be. Sometimes it's not the channel experts. Sometimes it's the influencers that are thinking about doing it a bit differently, especially if you're looking at not even just social channels, but in the B2B world, business communities. Or we've all seen the guys on LinkedIn these days turning into Facebook, isn't it? Fascinating. You see all these marketing in our industry, the marketing gurus that are doing comedy video posts, and they're becoming huge influencers in the space, more so than some CEOs are. And they're creative people or people who work in, you know, agency teams. So, yeah, asking the right people, I think, doesn't necessarily mean asking a traditional expert, which is quite interesting.
Do you think that, because it's such a significant number of marketing agencies who are outsourcing, do you think this signifies that there's a bit of a change going on in terms of the structure of marketing agencies? Do you think they're becoming a little bit more flexible, changing from their traditional structure?
Well, I thought it was really interesting the way the article was worded. I wouldn't agree that agencies are outsourcing as a wholesale comment. I think that's quite broad. I think there's been a huge uptick in smaller agencies that are experts in certain spaces, but that means clients are diversifying. That doesn't mean agencies are outsourcing. So I wonder how much has been wrapped up into that statement. Definitely seeing the landscape diversify. You know, we ourselves are a disruptive agency. There are many out there, all, you know, for a very good reason. And that's the state of the market. There's been so much change, so much disruption. In the last 5 years, 4 years have been insane. And with that comes opportunity. With opportunity comes new agencies and new people building solutions. And clients want to try that. They want to try that because they know it'll work. And those companies will be bought by the larger agencies in the next few years and the whole cycle will start again. But yeah, I think that's probably more what's happening, in my humble opinion.
So yeah, no, really, really interesting conversation around agencies there and around that story. I'll take us on to our second story of the week, which is that streaming giant Netflix has launched a new cheaper subscription plan that will run adverts alongside its content. The Basic with Ads subscription will be available across several markets in North America and Europe from early November. Basic with Ads is Netflix's first subscription to include ads since the company's launch in 2007. The company has estimated that between 5 and 10% of its titles won't be available on the ad-supported tier to begin with due to licensing restrictions, although Netflix is working to reduce this figure over time. So, Lindsay, I'll come to you first. How do you think Basic with Ads will be received by viewers?
I just don't know. I saw a stat come in my inbox the other day that I think there's a survey from, who was it? Watch TV Abroad did some research, and they said 1 in 4 streamers from this research won't tolerate commercials, regardless of any form of saving they could get from the tier price. But 28% would do it for a discount. It didn't really matter what the discount was. It was some kind of saving. And I think that, you know, actually 1 in 4 not wanting to go down the ad-funded route is actually quite low. So if 75% actually wanted to consume ads for a discount, great. I mean, it's hard to know. From a Netflix perspective, do they actually want, would they rather have 75% go to the basic model for the ad-funded model, or would they still rather have them go for the top tier? Obviously, the top tier, you'd imagine, would be the real boon for them in terms of revenue. Mm. So if only a small proportion actually went to the ad-funded route, that's still going to mitigate the loss. I didn't read the article properly about when this was launching, so I eagerly forced Kieran, our founder and CSO, to create an ExchangeWire Netflix Basic account this morning, Basic Plus Ads account. Hurriedly did it.
For research. There, yeah. Research purposes. Right.
Sat there watching Cobra Kai, getting very bored, wondering when the ads are going to start. We were in the office going, come on ads. And then I think somebody in the office said, actually, they don't start till November the 3rd. So that was a waste of 10 minutes. And I was, very strange morning. But we now have an account. I'm really interested to see what it's like, because obviously they're going to be pre-rolls and mid-rolls. So nothing particularly snazzy at this point, and nothing particularly, you know, 15 to 30 seconds. So a bit like what you would get in any kind of BVOD in this country already. So what you get on All4 or ITV Hub or whatever. And I think that because many consumers are quite used to consuming content in that way from BVOD, and if they've got any set-top boxes or whatever, they would consume it in a similar way. It's not like everything that consumers watch is ad-free. It's only really Netflix and Disney Plus and a couple of other streaming platforms that are completely ad-free. Everything else has some form of ad. And you know, Generation Z, or Gen Z, as I probably should say, because that's what the Americans say, is they're fairly used to consuming ads, you know, from YouTube consumption and that kind of thing. So I kind of feel like, I think that it's $4.99. So if the top tier is something like, what, $15.99? It's a huge saving on the top tier. I think the tier I pay for is like $11.99. So even that is, you know, it's more than 50% off. So that's to consume a few ads, it could be worth it. I'm pleased that we've done this ExchangeWire just to experiment with it and see what it's like, because I'm fascinated. And if I think I can cope with the ads, I may downgrade, because it's a bit of a saving a month for a platform I don't use a significantly huge amount. Why not? Sorry, that was long-winded. I mean, no, take from that what thorough. You will. But yeah, I'm just intrigued. I'm very excited.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm delighted that ExchangeWire now has our own Netflix account. I wasn't aware of that.
Indeed, yes. So, yep.
The work here is done, Lindsay.
Izzy, what do you think? How do you think?
I mean, my God, it's a lot to unpack, isn't it? It's a lot to unpack in a quick podcast. highlights, who is this for, was my sort of first question. I mean, do I think it's a smart thing to do? Yes. I mean, they say, don't they, any platform that can monetize to advertising will do eventually, because it's a heck of a lot of money. And I don't think that, you know, Reed Hastings needs to worry about the cannibalization, people leaving the account in droves. They've done that post-COVID. They're coming back again. And they're going to make a fortune. Advertisers will be chomping at the bit to advertise on Netflix. And they might be doing the standard stuff now, but they pioneered with data, with their content creation and the way that you can target and hyper-target to the people that are actually watching different things and segment and everything. They'll have, you watch, they'll have the best solution out there in the next year. You bet they will. They're just rushing out now to start making money straight away when they're facing a recession. That's the first thing I would say. Secondly, the content they have access to. You've already got advertisers like Primark desperately trying to align to Stranger Things, which is not a natural. I mean,
not at all, not even close.
Yeah. Not in the slightest, no.
Desperate for my Stranger Things hoodie from Primark. So, you know, there's the content aspect, the data, they've got some very smart people they're going to make a truckload of cash off this. That would be my initial reaction. I'm surprised it's taken them so long. From a pricing perspective, I'm puzzled. I mean, in the US, I think the difference is $7 to $10 a month or something. I mean, you're going to lose 10% of your inventory, only save $3 a month and watch 5 minutes of ad every hour? Is the recession that bad? I know it is that bad, but I mean, people in that situation, very sad situation, will cancel Netflix or probably already have. So I sort of admire and I'm sort of looking with interest at this middle model they've got going on where they're still charging people and they're going to rake it in on the ad inventory side. And I wonder actually, because I'm a cynical beast, I wonder if actually this is just the gateway to putting ads on everything and making people pay for it.
Interesting.
Equally cynical. I mean, you could be right about that, actually. I mean, because let's not forget, this is the man that categorically denied ever getting ads on the platform. And, well, look where we are now. So anything could honestly happen. And I think what's interesting is, like, there have been lots of numbers being floated around as to what the CPM will be. I've heard £50, I've heard £65 or $65, which actually is now, you know, we're pretty much a parity of the US anyway, so it's about the same thing, which are, you know, that's astronomical in and of itself. But, you know, in the US where there's so many different streaming platforms, a lot of these different skinny bundles, you know, as you said, I think that there will be maybe a notion where, because there's so many different platforms available, so many, far more than we have in the UK, people will just go, sod Netflix, I'll just find other content elsewhere because there's so many different options. But I also think that the countries this is launching, I think Mexico is one of them. Mexico is a great example of not being able to, like, what advertiser in Mexico is going to pay that CPM? So I'd be fascinated to know what the CPMs look like on a market by market basis. Having recently been in Southeast Asia for our ATS Singapore event and talking about CTV there and talking about Netflix and Disney going down the ad funded route in markets like that, which, you know, massively huge rise in middle class, everything is mobile consumed. Mexico is no different. The concern around ads will be things like load time based on data packages and how much data they have available and the cost of an ad versus the cost of streaming more generally, but also what advertiser is going to pay that kind of CPM. So they will have to. In Indonesia, you pay about $6 CPM for connected TV ad inventory. Yeah. So are Netflix going to lower their CPM prices that much? How much value does their content actually hold in market in the kind of rising middle class markets like that? That's what I think will be very interesting.
Yeah, and this is the beginning of a journey. That's what this is. Because you're absolutely right. This is an early adopter market. This is going to be driven by large US companies spending a lot of money to be an early adopter in a platform to do something different. And the people on the ground in some markets will not benefit from that in the short term, you know? And it's like the pricing model. It just smacks of somebody sitting in a boardroom and saying, I really want to bring in ads. And the person in charge saying, you better not lose me all my subscription revenue while you bring in this model, you crazy bean. And that person going, I tell you what, we'll hedge our bets and we'll keep some revenue coming in on it and we'll test the market and transition to an ad model potentially or something. Because they've seen subscriptions fall, they know subscriptions are in a bit more territory. So I would say it's definitely a journey for them. This is not what it's going to be, whatever it is. It's the start of that. And I'm interested. Yeah.
I think you've touched upon this, Lindsay, previously, but I wanted to ask you, Izzy, do you think that, you know, it's been, to put it politely, a tumultuous year for Netflix in terms of their subscribers you know, they're now seeing an uplift in subscribers again after having lost so many in the first half of the year. But do you think this kind of very, you know, as I said, tumultuous year might create some reservations amongst advertisers at this early stage?
I think that advertisers at the moment are definitely looking for new things to get, you know, arrest people's attention and build their brands, for sure. So I actually think that it will probably do quite well. It's attributable. It's got a lot of data behind it. It will have a CPM that people can negotiate or not. The price point will find itself based on what people are booking on it. I don't think it's a risk. I mean, maybe I'll eat my words. I don't know. I don't think this is a particular risk. And the one thing that Netflix has is content. Content is what's fixing their subscription issue. It's not pricing. And as we head into a recession, I think human behavior, which is the thing that drives advertising for all of us, is how we behave. there's a lot of people that won't be going out. And actually, paying the subscription amount or whatever it is for Netflix to sit down and have access to binge-worthy shows where you can spend the entire weekend in your gym jams, or you can put something on for your kids, will be, you know, people pay to be entertained.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So I'm not worried about the advertising side. I do think that they'll make a lot of money on it, and that will probably shift from other things, and a lot of that will be linear TV. You've got to think about linear TV. That's a beast in the market. People still put a lot of advertising dollars to it. Baffles me, really. But
I agree.
It's going down. This will definitely help hasten the end of that. That's where the money will come from.
Fantastic. I'll take us on now to our final story for this week's podcast, which is that research from Consult My App has found that 77% of CMOs are set to increase their marketing spend over the next 12 months, despite 44% expecting that the possible recession will negatively impact their businesses. The research, which surveyed 100 CMOs of companies with over 250 employees, found that marketing budgets are predicted to rise by an average of 20% across 2023. Brand building and new service introductions are expected to see the greatest amount of growth, with 42% of respondents listing them as key areas for investment. So Izzy, I think I'll come to you first on this. What do you think these results suggest about the marketing industry?
Oh, gosh. I mean,
big question.
Do I agree with the results? Might be the place to start. I mean, look, I'm sure it was a really great survey, and I'm sure a lot of brands are looking to address their advertising budgets going into next year. There's certainly a lot more certainty around budgets next year. This year has been insane, and a lot of people have been making short-term decisions to sit back, really assess what it is they need to do, what's the market doing. I think a lot of people embrace that, okay, we're not going to know, change is clearly here to stay, but we can at least make a safer bet for January onwards. I think budgets are more secure for next year. That would be what I would say. I don't know if they're an actual real for real increase. I think this year there have been decreases. And it just sort of strikes me maybe a little bit like one of those political arguments where they say we're investing more money into the police force, when what they actually mean is we've cut it for like X number of years and we're bringing it up by a certain percentage. So I'm conscious I'm waffling. But I found, with the research overall, I just had more questions, really. And the conversations that we're having with our clients are around, we know what we want to do and we know how much we have. And those conversations are very practical. They're driven by, yes, we want to be more aware or have people more aware of our brand, but we've been having those conversations since the start of COVID, especially with larger products. So I work in B2B anyway. Those decisions are longer tail. They're larger dollar items. They cost a lot to do. This isn't FMCG. So yeah, those people weren't making decisions anymore. So they had to concentrate on brand advertising so that when people were ready to buy, they could make that decision. And that's true of cars and electric cars, where people don't know what's happening anymore about the energy supply situation, all that kind of thing. So yeah, brand is important. Spend is more stable, but I'm not sure that's a new thing. Yeah.
Lindsay, what do you think?
I'm fascinated by Izzy's perspective on this, because obviously, Izzy, you're in the thick of it, you know, actually running a B2B marketing agency and speaking to advertisers exactly about this kind of stuff and looking into kind of what the appetite is for budget next year and what the appetite is for different types of advertising. But the first thing I thought when I read the headline was brand building. And then when obviously went into the stats around kind of the reasons why budgets are increasing, I'm using air quotes here because I'm fascinated by Izzy's perspective on the actual, what the increases actually mean. Hmm. And I'm just going to echo everything Izzy just said, that, you know, we saw the same thing during COVID. During COVID, when a lot of businesses actually couldn't run, they still kept always on activity on TV and digital, on radio to remind people of their existence. So when people were ready to spend again, or when companies were ready to actually do stuff again, they would be front of mind. And we saw that at the last recession as well. We'll see the same thing in this recession, certainly from big companies, certainly from, you know, from very, very consumer heavy, consumer led companies like FMCGs, like car brands, like electronics brands, like TV companies, those kinds of things. I think we will see a lot of that. The interesting bit for me is the fact that, Izzy, you think that actually the budgets have gone almost decreased this year. Like, what do you think? What do you think drove that? Because I would have.
I think it's uncertainty.
Right.
I think it's uncertainty that drives that. And I'm not saying for all sectors necessarily. I am absolutely sure that some people listening to this will be going, not for me. They've definitely gone up. Well, yes, probably a thing. But overall, definitely the sense I'm getting is when there's uncertainty, people want time to make better decisions. And they will go to safe places to spend to keep their bottom line going while they buy themselves some time. So we've seen double downs in areas like upsell, cross-sell, like working with their own data sets, trying to understand more about people's patterns of behavior, what they're buying, why they're buying. And that, you know, led me to another thought I had when I read it, which is, what are they considering marketing spend? Because that's such a broad thing. So much gets folded under marketing. I would say innovation spend has gone up. That doesn't necessarily affect people designing ads or putting, you know, media out there necessarily. But I'll give you an example from the B2B sector because that's my bread and butter. We've got a lot more people in the last few years that have been trying to move to cloud or edge to cloud services, hybrid solutions, cars, again, you know, moving more. What's the future? What are we trying to move people towards? And let's use this pause to really make sure we're getting the business stable and looking at that future. That's why Netflix have done what they've done. Be under no illusion. There's a total business decision based on what the future of the market looks like. Everyone's doing that. And I think that's what the pause this year has been. And then next year, I think the reason there will be more brand is everyone will want to tell the new story about who they are, what they have, why they're ready for everybody, and super cynical alert again, why they care, because they're community driven and they care about their customer and their end user. How people do that will be the most interesting thing. People's drivers are the same. How they communicate that message. Some brands are going to really shine through this. The ones that get it right are going to really shine. Some brands are not going to get it right. Like poor old HSBC having their ads around Davos pulled down because they were decided to be not as sustainable as they were trying to get across. Things like that. There's going to be some misfires. But that, I think, is what will drive the brand building. I think it's describing their who they are and why they're still relevant.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I think that you're absolutely right about the it's the driver. And you know, you're talking about the messaging that's going out there. Actually, it almost feels like brands are taking a step back at the moment to kind of really understand what is going to be important for consumers next year. And important for consumers, I mean, certainly in the UK, given the summer we've had, and it's really kind of made people aware of sustainability and net zero and kind of driving reduced carbon emissions. I think that the messaging around that will be much more sustainability focused and environmentally focused. And so maybe they're kind of biding time to work out exactly how they go about that and not make huge mistakes like HSBC did, for example. And I actually, you know, anecdotally on the grapevine, I've heard from a couple of ad tech companies, them say that their budgets this quarter or Q3 have been reducing. Now, again, that's just grapevine chat. Who knows what that actually means in practice? And again, it kind of makes you think, well, are people just kind of reducing things again to be able to work out how they can really prepare themselves for next year? And it's an anecdote I've used a few times, but Scott Messer from Leaf Group, he wrote an amazing post kind of the start of COVID about his cousin who's a farmer in Idaho, and he said, you know, what happens, you can only farm farm potatoes at certain times of year. Well, what do you do in winter? Do you just sit around and have a party and eat the potatoes? He's like, absolutely not. No, we take stock of everything. We look at everything. We take all of our kit, all of our technical engineering stuff apart. We clean it, we fix it, we rebuild it, and we go again. And he was using that as an analogy for what companies need to do in hard times. Stop, take a look at things, work out what is working, isn't working, rebuild it, and then go again. And I feel like there'll be a lot of that again, as there was during COVID, probably a lot of that again over the coming kind of months.
God, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that streamlining effort is exactly what people are doing at home with their bills. Let's go through everything we spend and let's go through everything we have. Where can we turn the lights off? Where can we make sure that we're not spending on 5 different ad subscription services for TV when we could be spending on 3? And they're doing with that ad tech. I mean, if we're being honest with ourselves, there's been a lot of ad tech over the last X number of years that have billed themselves as a silver bullet. A lot of these companies have patchwork ad tech and martech systems. They don't all speak together. They've been brought in by different people, and people will streamline those. And, you know, that does affect companies like the Salesforces of the world's map systems, ad exchange, even like, you know, We're working with two clients right now to slim down their programmatic platforms because they're live on three different programmatic solutions and they want to just go down to one. And they're looking at innovation, not who's the biggest in the market, because innovation is what's going to push their brand next year. And that's what I mean. There's going to be some interesting winners and losers. And I would bet on some smaller companies. I really would. The ones that have, obviously, I'm not just saying that because we are one. I think that disruption happens when there's opportunity. And that will definitely happen with this idea of what people are doing next year as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is interesting because looking through the report, brand building was one of the biggest priorities, but also new service introductions was an area that's anticipated to see a huge amount of growth, which seems to, I'm curious as to whether you both think that's potentially quite risky in the context of a recession where people are looking to streamline and cut back to be focusing so much and investing in introducing new services. Did you have any particular thoughts on that?
I think for some people, it's like Netflix, they're doing it like, what is the service, I guess, is the answer to that. Like, that could mean many things. Yes, many people might have product launches that would be really, really good in the height of a kind of peak economy, but would be absolutely disastrous to launch them during recessions. So they're probably going to hold back. All the R&D that's gone into that will kind of be lost and they'll have to wait a couple of years until things are calmed down a bit. But there will be other services that have to be introduced for reasons like money saving or things like Netflix, I'm introducing different tiers that I think, you know, probably can go ahead. But because of that, I do think that the percentage, which I forget what the actual percentage was higher than I thought.
42%.
Yeah, 42%.
I think I think a lot of companies are still in-housing their data efforts. That's one thing that is a flag for me, because it's been talked about for a very long time. We want to own our own data. We want to own our own DMP. We want to understand our own customers. People, they've tried. It's a huge job and no one's really, well, a few companies have got it right, but not many. So I think data is really key, and that might be an area of the innovation, because people are now more conscious about who is seeing their advertising and why. And before, it didn't matter if you had huge data bloat or you had issues. It was like, oh, right, everyone's got 20 devices. That makes sense. Let's carry on. That's really just not an argument anymore. I think we'll see a lot of nuts and bolts innovation underneath platforms that already exist to make them more efficient and make them more fit for purpose. Again, because a lot of companies, and I love these companies, I feel so bad saying it, have been relying almost on this silver bullet approach. They've got these amazing products to market and they continue to tinker with them. And I think that's important.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. I think that concludes the story section of our podcast. Moving on to the second part of our podcast, which really is just to talk to you a little bit more, Izzy, about Realm, about what you guys do and anything in particular you're working on at the moment. So take it away.
Oh, crikey. Talk about me?
Yes.
Little old you.
All right. Okay. You said it in the beginning, Realm's a media agency, effectively a global media agency. And we were born at the height of the pandemic. So born in 2020, really just based on three key tenets, really. Number one, do better work for our clients in a way that makes sense. So we've really lent into hybrid working. Ties in really interestingly with that point about how people are working differently with agencies. A lot of companies are in-housing certain sections now. They don't want traditional agency models. So we really try and work with them to fill in gaps. We're much more flexible, much more agile, much more part of the client. And it is working wonders for us. We work with some very large brands right out of the gate, you know, because those are the companies that need support from people that know what they're doing within their ecosystems. So that was the first thing. And the other thing that we're really working on is just being a good partner. So building on diversity and inclusion and flexible working and making sure that everything we do is accountable on a digital level. And then passing those cost savings back on, really. So a bit of a different approach, I think. None of us are really after yachts on the Gold Coast, which is a bit helpful, I find. And I think the things that have been most exciting for us, if I put it that way, because no one wants to listen to creds on a podcast, Hannah, they really don't. but if anybody wants to go to our website, please do. The things that Realm are doing that I'm most proud of at the moment are a lot of this brand work that we were talking about before. We're working with some very large companies, and I mean like FTSE 100 companies, to design their brand activities for next year, full brand demand activities for next year, based on really making them visible as to who they should be as a company and what that future is. And that's why I've been so passionate about it, I think, on this podcast, and working through their tech systems to make sure that's delivered on a B2B level to the right customers. So that joined up thinking, I think, and the teams that we've got around us, they're fantastic. Understanding their business, not just understanding the channels. That's the thing that's really crucial, because you can design really good media campaigns till the cows come home, but if it's not fit for the right audiences that are consuming them, they'll do what they say on the tin, but they won't work. And in this time of recession, that's why I think people are looking to smaller disruptive agencies. They're looking for practical help, new thinking that will get campaigns that actually work for them and how they operate and for their customers. And that just doesn't fit the big model anymore. It doesn't fit, you know, programmatic teams with 400 people in them, and it goes to a junior and you just buy a data segment and activate it and wonder why you've got, you know, 50 million people to your homepage but no downloads.
And that's your background though, right? Your background is from the working with big media agencies. So going from that to Realm now, I mean, what's fascinating is, do you find that what you're doing now is much more consultative than maybe you had the opportunity to at the big media agencies? Because as you said, you know, a client would come with a brief, you go, yep, right, give it to this team member here, all done, all sorted. Do you find now that you're almost coaching and educating the clients much more, and you've got the chance to do that more than maybe you did before?
I mean, yes, and I think that's a symptom of setup. I mean, I've worked in large media agencies for about 24 years, and there are some very smart people that work there. I've worked with some amazing people at the time, and because I don't work for them anymore, I can say I think a lot of them are constrained by the setup and the logistics they're given. These are multiple P&L companies, and when a brief goes to them or a significant, you know, campaign goes to them, it gets divided up amongst sometimes 10 companies, and each of those 10 companies within that company have their own objectives and need to read their own efficiencies, and you lose money, you lose margin every way down that line. And some companies are attempting to solve for that through offshoring, which is great when it works, but we all know that all depends on the brief you get. Anyone that's ever worked in coding or delivery or technological delivery or no, if you put S in, you get S out, right? So yeah, I think that it's symptomatic of the setup, because these large agencies are a network of other smaller agencies, and being able to specialize in B2B and really understand the finance industries, the technology industries, the manufacturing industries really makes you understand why people make decisions. And then you just build campaigns from there. You're not trying to build from the tactic. And I just think that's a huge problem that some agencies have with some smart people, but some difficult logistics.
Yeah. Like giant moving oil tankers rather than nimble speedboats, like the disruptors. And I'm also fascinated by kind of B2B marketing. And obviously, as you said, Realm specializes in B2B. I feel like B2B is often an often misunderstood form of advertising, form of marketing. Kind of what are the big differences in terms of how you would approach B2B marketing versus how you'd approach B2C marketing?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I say is very rarely people start in B2B on purpose. We all fall into it and then we fall in love with it and then we never leave and then we all become the same, you know, so we all know each other. It's that kind of an industry. Look, you know, when you're trying to be innovative and you're trying to build really creative things, I think those are the bits that we love the most. That's why we do our jobs. We like thinking, we like coming up with answers to solutions and, you know, that kind of thing. The more constraints you have, the more creative you have to be to address those constraints. If you had unlimited budget and unlimited audiences and any KPIs, you wouldn't come up with anything because anything would fit it. And B2B is a small box. You have very niche audiences that behave in certain ways, that operate on different platforms, and a very crowded market, a very high spending. There's a lot of money in B2B, high spending technology or finance companies or whatever it is. So you have to be innovative and disruptive, and it's harder. I've worked in consumer and I've worked in B2B, and to my mind, B2B is more interesting because it's more complicated, and you also have to think more about what it is that you want to do. That's the bit that I love, that's the bit. And I think the reason that B2B gets a bad rep is people just see the barriers They just see the barriers and they think that it makes it boring or dull, or they think that B2B is behind consumer. I hear that all the time. That might have been true 10 years ago. It's not true now. Everybody's got the same ad tech, the same, you know, it's more complicated. B2B is not behind. B2B has got there. B2B is innovating. It's a great time to be alive.
Amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much, Izzy, for joining us this week. And thank you, Lindsay, as well, for
thank
joining
you.
Us.
Thank you. And your voice held out, Izzy. Thank God.
Yeah, wonderful. It's all a goofy. Yeah.
No, fantastic. Thanks so much, for joining us this week. That was this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.